My father's favorite, music from the film Sense and Sensibility, starring Emma Thompson, Kate Winslet, and Hugh Grant. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. It would seem that Jane Austen is more popular than ever. Another film based on one of her books opens this week, Mansfield Park. Her books continue to be treasured, and they continue to be bestsellers. And her image, in caricature, shows up on T-shirts, tote bags, and coffee mugs. Jane Austen, literary superstar. This afternoon, a look into the life and times of Jane Austen. Our guest is Natalie Tyler, author of The Friendly Jane Austen, a well-mannered introduction to a lady of sense and sensibility. The book is an entertaining companion to Jane Austen, and if you've not yet discovered her work, here's a winning introduction. The book on Jane Austen is the fourth in Viking Penguin's Friendly series. Other books in the series, The Friendly Charles Dickens and The Friendly Shakespeare. Our guest, Natalie Tyler, the author of The Friendly Jane Austen, is a professor of English literature at Ohio State University. Questions for Natalie Tyler are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Natalie Tyler, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to be with you this afternoon.
Thank you.
Your introduction to Jane Austen was Pride and Prejudice. You were 16 years old. How was it that that was the first Austen novel you read?
Well, somebody gave it to me, and he gave me also three of her other novels at the same time and suggested that I begin with Pride and Prejudice.
Hmm. And is that good advice?
I think so. I think for the beginning reader, it really welcomes you to the world of Jane Austen. It introduces her mode of writing, her types of characters, and it includes some of the best-loved heroes, heroines, and villains and villainesses in Jane Austen's work. It's also very sparkling and effervescent.
Mm-hmm. What kind of impression did it make on you as a 16-year-old girl?
When I was 16, the irony of Jane Austen completely passed me by. For example, the third of the five Bennet sisters, Mary, is really very pedantic and boring and speaks in false imitation of 18th-century scholars. Well, she blew me away. I thought, what a profound intellect. Here's a girl just my age, and she knows so much. How I admire her.
And when was it that you began to think there was more going on than you had first realized?
When I was in college, I took a class with a wonderful professor who introduced me to the ironic overtones in Jane Austen. They're not difficult to miss if you're even a semi-sophisticated reader, but I think I had to be led to the irony,
yeah.
And then I truly appreciated it.
The Friendly Jane Austen includes interviews with many people who love Austen and who have studied her work. One of them is Emily Auerbach at the University of Wisconsin, and she told you, "The image that I like to think about when talking about Jane Austen is hidden pictures." Would you explain?
Yes. I think she was referring to those puzzles that children often see where there's a picture, but hidden within the tree, say there's a little steam shovel, or hidden on the child's pants leg, say, is a lollipop. And I think that when you first read Jane Austen, or at least when I first read Jane Austen, I read her strictly for the story, for the plot line, to see who would end up with who. Would there be a marriage at the end? How would it all culminate? But in fact, she has embedded in her novels a lot of very, very interesting commentary on her times, on the people of her times. And if you look into it a little bit closer, you start seeing some of these hidden messages.
Mm. That's a very friendly way to think about it, I think, as well, hidden pictures.
Yes, I really enjoyed that analogy that Emily came up with.
Yeah. In that interview, she also told you she's run across some readers who don't like Austen. Have you found many?
I have had a few students in my classes, mostly young men of about 17, 18, or 19 years of age, who really didn't like reading Jane Austen. I think that probably had more to do with their feelings about the novel and the length of the novel than about Jane Austen herself. She doesn't obviously have any thrilling violence or any action-packed features. She's not a comic book. I don't think I've met any adults who've read Jane Austen and disliked her.
Yeah. Now, Mark Twain, though, we can't meet him, but he seemed to have a very strong reaction against her work.
Oh, yes, indeed. He said that it was a tragedy that Jane Austen didn't die before she did, because then it would have saved the world. Reading, he said that his own library didn't include Pride and Prejudice, which improved the library considerably. There are quite a few people, famous people, indeed, who don't like Jane Austen. Mark Twain was probably the best-known commentator on her negatively. But also, Charlotte Bronte had a negative reaction, and she thought Austen was very cultivated but commonplace, and said, "I should hardly like to live with her ladies and gentlemen in their elegant but confined houses." But I think Charlotte Bronte enjoyed being out on the moors. And develop more melodramatic characters.
Mm-hmm. Now, back to Mark Twain for a moment. You know, he was such a wag and such a commentator. Could he have been, you know, just being a wise guy about Jane Austen, saying that, you know, any library that didn't have her books would be a great library?
Yes. I don't know. He also said, "I could read Poe's work on salary, but not Jane's. Jane is entirely impossible. It seems a great pity that they allowed her to die a natural death." I don't know a lot about Mark Twain's reactions to 19th century literature in general.
And it could have been also that he was, you know, I don't know what he would have thought of, you know, anyone that was British in writing, as a matter of fact. I don't know.
That's true. And also, he was reading Jane Austen towards the end of the Victorian age. And in Victorian times, I think Jane Austen's family attempted to cultivate a public image of Jane Austen as being very, very pious, extremely respectable, and they tried to create almost a Saint Jane about her. And that kind of reputation, which appeared in the earliest biographies of her that were published by her family members, may indeed have put him off if he was familiar with them.
Yeah. That is so un-Jane Austen, though. She regularly skewered things such as, you know, guides to conduct and manners and whatnot.
Absolutely, she did.
Yeah.
But I think that after her death, her family wanted to create a picture of her for posterity of a very gentle, pious woman.
Well, now let's talk about another writer who seems to like Jane Austen quite well, and that's T.C. Boyle.
Yes. I interviewed him for my book, and he was most delightful. He's written a short story that I could recommend to anyone called I Dated Jane Austen. And in his typical way he flings together postmodernisms and literary references. He's highly educated. He received a PhD in English literature and has a little duel with Henry Crawford, a character from Mansfield Park, over the virtue of Jane.
Yeah. Do you have the book there?
Yes, I do.
Could you go to page 153 and at a point in the interview with T.C. Boyle, you ask him, "So you dated Jane Austen?" And would you read for us his response?
Yes. He said, "I don't generally like kiss-and-tell stories, and I very rarely pull the plug on my dates, disastrous or otherwise. But in the case of I dated Jane Austen, my baser instincts took over. I'm afraid, you see, I'd admired her from afar. She was famous, after all, and I was just starting out, having published maybe 24 stories or so, and I was surprised when she agreed to go out with me at all. She was a bit older, you understand, but since age and such circumstances is such a touchy subject, I never pressed her to reveal just how much older than I she was. I got the sense that she was inwardly toting up my shortcomings, hair, dress, accent, that sort of thing, and that I wasn't really doing too well. She was funny, I guess, in a very dry, Englishy sort of way, but she had cute eyes, and those curls and mob cap just killed me. But as you can see from my account, it was Cassandra whose candles I really lit. With her, I might have had a chance. Unfortunately, I was unable to pursue it, for one thing, and I never revealed this to Jane, though she would have secretly thrilled to know it, I was already engaged."
Mm, that's marvelous.
When he speaks of Cassandra, of course, he's talking about Jane's older sister.
Right. Tell us about her and their relationship.
They were very close. Cassandra was just about 2 years older than Jane. They were the only two daughters in a family of six brothers. And they essentially lived together for their entire lives. Whenever they were separated, they wrote each other lengthy letters. And unfortunately, after Jane's death at some point, Cassandra chose to destroy almost all the letters. So we only have, I think, just about 100 extant.
Yeah.
It's often been speculated that she destroyed the juicier letters, or letters that might have been objectionable because of Jane's ironic tone, or perhaps Jane criticized people that they knew.
Yeah. It's interesting that those letters were destroyed, but Austen's early, very, very early writing has survived. How did that happen, do you suppose?
I think Cassandra had a great deal of respect for Jane as a formal author. Jane Austen began writing when she was very young, and when she was in her early 20s, she compiled all the things that she had written as a teenager and recopied them into three notebooks very neatly, labeling them Notebook the First, Notebook the Second, Notebook the Third. And I think that Cassandra, in spite of the fact that some of these stories are quite bumptious,
mm-hmm.
Quite full of drunkenness, adultery, and all kinds of rather unseemly topics, nonetheless, Cassandra thought she had to preserve the legacy of Jane's formal writing.
Yeah. You include in the book some highlights of these early writings. And if I could ask you here to go to pages 32 and 33 and just share a couple of lines or a couple of paragraphs that she wrote as a young girl. She began writing, if I'm remembering correctly, from The Friendly Jane Austen at the age of 12.
Yes. And most of these pieces from which I'm about to quote were written from actually, I think the age of 11 up till about 16 or 17. From a very, very early work, she must have been only 11 or 12, Jack and Alice, she writes, "The Johnsons were a family of love, and though a little addicted to the bottle and dice, had many good qualities."
Hmm. And from Henry and Eliza.
From Henry and Eliza, which she also wrote at about the same time, I would guess perhaps age 13 or 14, one of her characters gets a little hungry and, quote, "She began to find herself rather hungry and had reason to think, by biting off two of her fingers, that her children were very much in the same situation." So you have a little bit of self-cannibalism in there, along with many other extremes in Henry and Eliza.
Yeah. And this is marvelous. "A letter from a young lady whose feelings being too strong for her judgment led her into the commission of errors, which her heart disapproved."
Yes, this is good. I believe Austin wrote this at about age 14 or 15. "I murdered my father at a very early period of my life. I have since murdered my mother, and I am now going to murder my sister. I have changed my religion so often that at present I have not an idea of any left. I have been a perjured witness in every public trial for these past 12 years, and I have forged my own will."
She had a wonderful sense of humor, didn't she?
Yes, and a wonderful imagination.
Oh. Natalie Tyler is our guest this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with Natalie Tyler about her book, The Friendly Jane Austen, A Well-Mannered Introduction to a Lady of Sense and Sensibility. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, if you've got questions about Jane Austen, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else you're listening, in Illinois or Indiana, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. So what was the Austen family like? What were her parents like?
Her father was a rector in the Church of England, a clergyman, and her mother, who was named Cassandra, seemed to have been very good parents in many ways. The family was close-knit. They had eight children. And the Reverend Austen, in order to gain a little bit of extra money, often took in boarders, young boys who were preparing to take entrance exams for Oxford or Cambridge. And so the house was full of young men who, I think, certainly encouraged Jane in her writing, in her wit. The house had an excellent library for a family of that time, so Jane Austen had abundant material to read. I think the atmosphere of the family was intellectual, but with a good sense of fun.
Mm-hmm. Home theatricals were part of the family mix.
Home theatricals, a home newspaper or journal that lasted for a while that was instigated by Jane, and it seems an enormous amount of affection from all the siblings towards each other. If there can be anything like a so-called dysfunctional family, the Austens were not it. I think there was a lot of close family support at all times, and I think one of the reasons that young Jane Austen became such a lively, witty, outgoing person was because of the encouragement of all the older people in her family, including her parents.
Yeah. You mentioned the library, and this is truly, I think, very interesting. This is quite a large library for a man of the cloth, 500 volumes.
Yes, it was a very large home library at the time, and it testifies, I think, to the pleasure that the Austens took in reading, not just in reading for the sake of education, although certainly that was probably paramount to their minds, mm-hmm. but for the pleasure of it. They read not just the classics, the Latin and Greek that were essential for the young men studying to get into Oxford, but they were up to date with all the latest books by, say, Samuel Johnson, plays by Sheridan, for example, and the other 18th century Restoration comedies. They had volumes of all the latest poets who were in vogue in the late 18th century, Cooper, Collins, for example.
It'd be great to visit there, to step back in time and visit that household.
Yes, unfortunately it was destroyed in the mid-19th century, and all that remains now is a field and I think a little pump, which is meant to be authentically from the period of Jane Austen. However, just a few miles from that field is the house where Jane Austen spent the last 6 years of her life, and that is a museum dedicated to Jane Austen, and it's open to the public, and they have had an enormous amount of visitors in the past few years especially.
She was born in 1775, and she died just some 40 years later in 1817.
Yes.
What caused her death?
She was only 41. At the time, Addison's disease had not been named. Dr. Addison described it, I think, late in the 19th, early in the 20th century. Many scholars have felt that her symptoms, as described in her letters, indicate that she had Addison's disease. Other biographers I've read, such as Claire Tomlin, are a little more dubious about that. I think it's very difficult to make posthumous diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is Addison's disease?
It's actually a form of tuberculosis. It's called malarial tuberculosis, which has nothing to do with malaria. And I think that some of the symptoms include jaundice, which Jane Austen evidently did have, but that could be some kind of liver disease. Generally, I think that we probably won't really know for a fact why she died. We do know a little bit about how she died, which was with fairly good humor. She wrote just 2 days before her death a very satiric poem, which indicates that her sense of humor was with her right up till the very end.
What did she look like?
We have actually only one portrait of her that was drawn by her sister Cassandra. And I think that she looks, although I may be reading my own feelings about Austen into this, I think she looks poised, a little distanced, a little satirical or ironic. Her many members of her family have described her as being anything from very beautiful to very good-looking. Some of the ladies in her neighborhood, when she was a young lady, wrote that Cassandra and Jane were truly beautiful and striking-looking.
There's a comment that you include here from a woman by the name of Mary Russell Mitford. And this doesn't quite connect with me. I'm not quite sure where this woman came up with this description, and maybe I just don't know. But this woman, Mary Russell Mitford, noted that her mother, said that Jane Austen was the prettiest, silliest, most affected, husband-hunting butterfly. I don't know, somehow that doesn't connect with my idea of Jane Austen.
No, and it's quite possible that the woman made the comment, having met Jane Austen only very briefly at a public event, a party, or an assembly ball, or something like that. I believe that Austen was certainly quite capable, and indeed did go out to parties, and although she would sometimes grouse about it in a private letter to Cassandra later on, tried her best to be a good party guest. And that probably would have included a modicum of flirting.
And someone else said that Jane and her sister Cassandra were perfect beauties and, of course, gain hearts by the dozens, or by dozens.
I think it was a very handsome family, and I regret that there is the only one image of Jane Austen. There were several portraits I've seen, and in my book I published some of them, of her brothers, showing them to be very handsome. Her family, with the single exception of Jane, had very long lives, and most of them lived well into the age of the photograph. So we have some photographs of them that show them to be strikingly good-looking elderly men. So I can well believe that their sisters were very beautiful.
Yeah. She was almost married.
She was almost married perhaps more than once. Indeed, she did accept an engagement proposal from a young man named Harris Big Wither. Harris had a couple of sisters who were good friends of Jane Austen's, and he lived in really a very large, elegant estate. Had Jane married him, she would have become mistress of this estate. And undoubtedly, it would have provided her with financial ease for herself and her entire family. I imagine that is why she accepted his proposal to begin with, that he did have so much to offer in terms of security, financially anyhow. The following morning after accepting his proposal, she woke up and told him that she had declined his offer. Nobody really knows why she declined his offer. I speculate that at that point she had already determined that she wanted to dedicate her life to writing, and knew that being the mistress of a large household would make that impossible. There's also the fact that he was not exactly stunningly good-looking, although I don't think Jane Austen would have been so superficial as to allow that to persuade her. But I think that she did not make the choice that Charlotte Lucas made in Pride and Prejudice to marry for financial security and therefore liberate her family from caring for her financially. I think Jane decided, possibly hoped, that she could make a success of her writing career.
Is there any sense that she would have loved this man?
I don't think there's any sense at all that she loved Harris Big Wither. I think there are some quotations in letters to Cassandra that she wrote before he proposed to her. She wrote that he had a, quote, bad habit of body. unquote. And I don't really know what that means.
Right.
Perhaps he bathed less often than she would have liked. There is very much a sense, however, that she may have very much loved a young man named Tom Lefroy, who she met when she was 20. He was a visitor to her neighborhood, and she wrote about him to Cassandra most enthusiastically. And she was very excited about him. His family, however, was counting on him to marry well and to earn money through marriage by marrying a rich young lady. And when they saw that he was getting very, very close to the young Jane Austen, who did not have very much money at all, they ordered him out of the neighborhood. And indeed, he did marry for money. However, when he was an old man and had become the Chief Justice of Ireland, he wrote that he had indeed loved Jane Austen.
Somewhere in the book, and I can't recall now, Natalie Tyler, whether it is something that Austen wrote or in fiction, or if it was correspondence between Jane Austen and her sister Cassandra Austen, and that is that perhaps even worse than being married to a man that you didn't love was being a teacher. But that says a lot about not wanting to be with someone that you don't love.
Yes. I think that comes from her very early brief novel, The Watsons, which is still accounted her juvenilia. I think she wrote The Watsons when she was perhaps 18 or 19 or 20. Emma Watson, the heroine, is a young woman from a family with absolutely no money, and she debates with her sister about what they're going to do with their future. And decides that to teach would be a worse fate than marrying a marriage without love.
Yeah, so it's right up there.
Yes. And I think a lot of that has to do with the very poor and difficult conditions the governesses had at this time.
Yeah. And also, she apparently did not have fond feelings for the teachers that she experienced in her formal education.
No, her formal education was very limited.
Yeah.
The Austens had started out sending Cassandra and Jane to a school where an outbreak of, I think, typhus fever occurred almost immediately after their arrival, and they were immediately sent back home, along with their cousin, who was attending the school. Unfortunately, Jane's aunt, who had accompanied them to the school, caught the disease, and it was fatal. So a couple of years later, once again the Austens tried to send their daughters to school. They were going to send Cassandra, but Jane insisted on coming with her and didn't want to be separated from Cassandra at all. So they went to the Abbey School in Reading, England, and it seems as though they may well have enjoyed themselves, but the academic program there was absolutely negligible. The headmistress was a Madame Latournelle, which was, of course, a French name that she had chosen from affectation. And she evidently told the girls a lot of really ghoulish stories that they enjoyed. There was a lot of laughter at the school, but no education. And when the Austens found that they could not sustain tuition for two girls, Cassandra and Jane went home quite happily, it seems.
Yeah. Well, I would think that the education at home would have been better than that at that school.
Yes, indeed it was. And I think probably the Austins wanted to give their daughters a touch of formal education, but because the schools for girls at the time were so, I think, haphazard in their approach to learning, that it really didn't amount to a whole lot except Jane referring in letters to Cassandra often about how we laughed at school, or I could die laughing the way we did at school.
Mm. There is a motif, thinking of these gory stories that they were told at school, and Jane's early writings, and that one that you quoted from earlier about the woman a la Lizzie Borden kills her father and her mother. This motif of decapitation and a fairly strong sense of people meeting with violent ends, where did that come from? Was it the stories that she heard at school?
It may well have begun with that. I'm more inclined to think, however, that as she got older, her imagination, her wonderful imagination, found a better outlet in developing characters rather than in heavily plotted stories where there are dramatic deaths and dramatic events. In her adolescence, I think she relied on plot. But when she became more serious about her writing, I think she was really driven to her strong point, creating and developing wonderful characters.
Mm-hmm.
And to her mature mind, I think that was much more interesting. The kind of phantasmagoric, almost Edward Gorey-like fantasies of her adolescent writing were subdued to the point where I think she realized it was in some ways more terrifying, more horrifying to have a character like Jane Fairfax perhaps being sent off to be a governess than to have the hallucinations, decapitations, and drunken sprees that she had written about so boisterously in her adolescence.
Yeah. Those early books, have they been published? I mean, if you wanted to go, well, say there, you wanted to go to the Jane Austen bookstore in Chicago, would they carry
Definitely.
These rights? So they're available.
Definitely they are. And in more than one edition. They weren't actually published until, I think, 1926. But since then, they've always been available. Anyone making a search of Jane Austen's books, I think even on the Internet, at one of the online bookstores, would be able to find them.
Mm. Maybe that's where Dave Barry should begin.
Oh, maybe he should.
let's bring the audience in on this. Dave Barry, you quote as saying about Jane Austen, you know, the movies. He's talking about the movies. He says, "I'm almost going to go into that movie with Emma Thompson, and then right next door there's a movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger crashes a jet ski into a helicopter, and I think that's probably more along my line of thinking." So maybe what Dave Barry needs to do is get one of these early books.
Yes, I think he might enjoy them very much.
And then graduate to Persuasion.
Yes. That's a fine idea.
How has Austen fared in Hollywood treatments of her work?
Well, I think that aside from the 1939, I believe it was, Pride and Prejudice, Hollywood didn't take up any of her scripts until the 1990s. The BBC in England had done quite a few in the 80s. But in the 1990s, we've seen, the wonderful A&E production of Pride and Prejudice, which did not come from Hollywood. We've had Sense and Sensibility. We've had a Hollywood Emma and an A&E Emma. We've had Clueless,
right,
which is a contemporary Emma. Mansfield Park is about to open nationwide. Northanger Abbey should be out next year.
Wow.
And
Persuasion was done by the BBC, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So that's all of them, all of her novels.
Yes, it is. And I think that for listeners who are interested, all of her novels are also in BBC productions. So at this point, we have four Prides and Prejudices. There are two Senses and Sensibilities out there, one from the BBC, and that's available on video, and then the movie with Emma Thompson.
Now, which is your favorite?
Of the films?
Yeah.
That's a very difficult question. All the films have pleased me in many ways. They've all had at least one actor or actress who I thought was doing the business just right. They've all had very felicitous lines, which, of course, were taken straight from Jane Austen. But they've also all had to compromise in some way, because you can't take these rather dense, complicated novels with such deep, profound characters and do it in 2 hours.
Yeah.
I think perhaps the BBC Persuasion came closest to the spirit of the Austen book without making compromises, and Persuasion is a shorter novel than most of the others. And I have a great fondness for Clueless. I think that Amy Heckerling's character is so much like Jane Austen's Emma that the spirit of Emma is really quite well embodied in Clueless.
Yeah. Speaking of Persuasion, perhaps we could end here with your thoughts on the last line of that novel.
The last line of the novel is, to get back to the idea of hidden pictures, somewhat difficult to interpret, I think. Let me see if I can find...
Isn't page 216?
Mm-hmm. The final sentence of Persuasion, referring to Anne Elliot, says, "She gloried in being a sailor's wife, but she must pay the tax of quick alarm for belonging to that profession which is, if possible, more distinguished in its domestic virtues than in its national importance." So clearly, Anne is happy with her marriage,
mm-hmm,
and very proud to be a sailor's wife. But the tax of quick alarm does bring in, I think, a sense of foreboding that,
mm-hmm,
isn't present at the end of any of the other novels. Perhaps her husband will be called away to a war.
It's a continuation of the nail-biting that begins very early on in the novel.
Yes.
Because you're not, you know, it's like, oh, will it all come together? Will it all be okay? And at the end here, we have sort of a continuation of those worries.
Yes. Yes, we do. And it's the only novel that ends with the rather frightening possibility that a husband might be hauled off to the dangers of battle, or that one of the wives will be alarmed by seeing her husband leave quickly. So this is not a tidy ending indeed,
mm-hmm,
and there's a lot of ambiguity in the sentence that seems to promise much domestic bliss for Anne Elliot, but with that caveat. yeah. what might happen.
The glass is half empty.
Perhaps, yes.
We're out of time. Natalie Tyler, I want to thank you for talking with us this afternoon. Fascinating subject. And I look forward over the holidays to reading some Jane Austen.
Well, thank you so much, Celeste, and I can't think of a better way for anyone to spend the holidays than reading Jane Austen.
Natalie Tyler. Look for her book, The Friendly Jane Austen, A Well-Mannered Introduction to a Lady of Sense and Sensibility.